We don't usually have metal bands on this show. But then again, we don't usually have 12-year-olds on this show. For a year, you were playing in Times Square.
Yeah, we made a lot of money.
Yeah? We made a lot of money?
Yeah, we made a lot of money.
How much would you make in a day?
About $1,600.
No, really? The middle school metalheads of a band called Unlocking the Truth make their radio debut today on Studio 360. Plus, the action-packed conclusion of Jack Handy's The Stench of Honolulu. Ancient civilizations, thwarted love, aerial attacks.
Something stuck in my forehead. It was a blow dart. I pulled the dart out and threw it away. But it stuck in my foot.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, the writer Renata Adler, who was a renowned young book and film critic before she tried her hand at writing a novel.
I just thought if you're going to be a critic, it isn't really fair not to have tried the thing you're writing about.
I'll talk with Renata Adler, whose novels from the 1970s and 80s have just been republished. But first...
Today I authorized the emergency manager for the city of Detroit to seek federal bankruptcy protection. This was a difficult and painful decision, but I believe there were no other viable options. From a financial point of view, let me be blunt. Detroit's broke.
That is Michigan Governor Rick Snyder announcing last week that Detroit had officially filed for bankruptcy. As the city tries to figure out how to get out from under its debt, maybe $18 billion worth or $25,000 per person, Detroit's creditors want all the city's assets on the table, including the art collection in the big, grand local museum, the Detroit Institute of Arts. Mark Stryker is a reporter at the Detroit Free Press, and he's been covering the cultural impacts of the city's financial meltdown. Mark, welcome to Studio 360.
Glad to be here.
So unlike in most museums, big encyclopedic museums like this, the city of Detroit actually owns this art, yeah?
That's correct. That's really what's put the museum in such a quandary at this point, is that the collection and the building are owned by the city of Detroit, and the museum is managed by a nonprofit, the Detroit Institute of Arts. The risk for the museum going forward is that municipal bankruptcy of this size and scope has never happened before, and dealing with assets like an art museum of this kind had never happened before. So we really are in uncharted waters in terms of how the law will react to what's happening here in Detroit.
Has there been any reliable appraisal of what this collection is worth?
No official appraisals have been done. We at the Free Press had a number of dealers and experts evaluate 40 of what we considered the museum's sort of greatest treasures. And for those 40 pictures, we're talking about $2.5 billion.
If, let's say, $2.5 billion is the ballpark for the 40 greatest works, I mean, when you say, well, that's 15% of the debt attributed to the city of Detroit, it's not insignificant.
No, not at all. That's why the creditors are looking at this art, because the fact is that the city of Detroit does not have a lot of assets that can be sold and realized to raise cash to offer these creditors more than the pennies on the dollar that Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, is currently offering.
And when we say creditors, I think it's important to be clear. People think, oh, that means banks and bondholders. Who cares? A bunch of rich people. No, isn't about half of this debt owed to pensioners, to public retired public employees?
It is true that some of this money, if art were sold, would go to shore up pension accounts and the like. So the question, in a way, becomes an existential sort of dilemma about who should take precedence here as we try and figure out how to remake the city of Detroit, and what role should a cultural asset play in that reorganization, and how do you balance the interest of an irreplaceable cultural legacy versus making sure the streetlights come on and
right,
making sure there are enough cops on the street and all of that. And it becomes a very complicated series of questions one starts to ask.
Is there a tipping point in terms of the museum where it becomes effectively destroyed and it can't raise money anymore and people are too – it just sort of is a spiral if it sells more than a couple of works?
Well, the tipping point could very well be selling one painting. If you sell even one work of art, then your wealthy donors and collectors will immediately dry up, because why would anyone give any money or any art to a museum that can't, in the end, protect it? People say, well, if you took just the five most expensive works, would anybody miss five works? Well, the fact is, when you take a Bruegel, a Van Gogh, a Matisse away from a museum, you're gutting the very greatness out of the soul of the place, and these are irreplaceable. And that comes back to this issue of, well, what is a city? Is a city simply a place that turns on the lights and has a police force and has a water department, or is a city a collection of cultural assets that form a locus of intellectual activity and creativity and aspiration and inspiration and all of those things that create a great urban area?
All well and eloquently put, although part of me, more than in a devil's advocate way, is sympathetic to this idea that in this extreme crisis where the lights can barely be turned on and you don't have enough police and you don't have enough ambulances, as much as one wants to keep this jewel of a museum at full strength, it becomes more than usually difficult to make that case for what all of the various cornerstones, as you say, of what a city is.
No question. Those are very legitimate counterarguments, and that's what makes this issue so complex.
And given that you know the ins and outs as well as anybody and all these variables, is it possible to have a hunch about how this is going to wind up?
Well, I'm loath to make predictions, but it would not surprise me if we take the next step and the art goes from the sidelines to the table, and then we fight about it in court to see what happens.
Well, I'm sure we'll be talking to you again as this plays out over the months and no doubt years to come. Mark Stryker, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
Mark Stryker is a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. So what do you all think? Is Detroit's art collection just another municipal asset that in this extreme crisis should be on the table to pay some of the city's debts? Or is the museum and its art in a special category? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
You don't have any money.
Broke is a joke.
And if you stop
voting. Broke is a joke.
And it's not voting.
Broke is a joke.
Not voting.
Still ahead today in Studio 360, we'll hear from a Texas judge who has cited John Steinbeck when making life or death decisions.
We can all agree that somebody like Lenny from Of Mice and Men is exactly the sort of person that people would say, Lenny should not be executed. Although he had strangled Curly's wife, clearly he was not really morally culpable.
Can a literary classic serve as a legal argument? That story's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. A lot of us have forgotten about the New Year's resolutions we made way back at the end of 2012. But four of our listeners are still hard at work making good on their creative undertakings because we keep nagging them every few weeks. Linda Brewer is sending a short story from Tucson every month. Ariel Lautman is woodworking away outside Washington, D.C. And Charlie Kapp is illustrating a graphic version of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You know, the one about the albatross. With the year half over, we thought we'd check in with Charlie to hear more about his 6 months of illustrating that 200-year-old epic poem.
Currently, I'm about halfway through the project. I've just finished up my 60-somethingth page yesterday, and I'm working on, I guess, 60-somethingth plus one. Today is my current page. I don't have an exact count off the top of my head. I try not to think about it too much. Otherwise, it feels like it's a little crazy-making to just feel it go one page at a time. But I'm about halfway through. Part the second. The sun now rose upon the right. Out of the sea came he, still hidden mist, and on the left went down into the sea. And the good south wind still blew behind, but no sweet bird did follow, nor any day for food or play came to the mariner's hollo. And I had done a hellish thing, and it would work 'em woe, for all averred I'd killed the bird that made the breeze to blow. It ends up being a diary of sorts for the last year so far, where I can look at it and have some odd associations with that, where I can say, like, oh, the death ship, as it approaches the ship, I made that when my folks visited. So it ends up being kind of my own recollections through the years and working on these things. I don't know, at some point it gets a little psychological, where I'm feeling like I'm starting to mirror the text that I'm writing about, where there's that day after day, day after day. He stuck, nor breath nor motion, to make a page about this sea voyage. Day after day, day after day, we stuck, nor breath nor motion, as idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean. Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. The very deep did rot, O Christ, that this should ever be. Yea, slimy things did crawl with legs upon the slimy sea. About, in reel and rout, the death fires danced at night. The water, like a witch's oils, burnt green and blue and white. And some in dreams assured were of the spirit that plagued us so. 9 fathom deep he had followed us from the land of mist and snow. It's having that kind of persistence to say, like, okay, the weather's beautiful. I'm not going to go for a walk. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to get the penciling done for this page. And then I'll go run an errand and then I'll come back and I'll ink this. And before I go to bed tonight, I'm going to have a complete thing to hang on the wall to get started again the next day. And every tongue, through utter drought, was withered at the root. We could not speak, no more than if we had been choked with soot. Ah, well a day, what evil looks had I from old and young. Instead of the cross, the albatross about my neck was hung.
You can see a slideshow of Charlie's work in progress at studio360.org, where you'll also find periodic updates from all 4 of our listeners who signed on to these unbreakable creative New Year's resolutions. I was pleased last week when a federal judge in Mississippi ruled that Woody Allen had not violated William Faulkner's copyright by quoting a Faulkner line in the movie Midnight in Paris. Pleased as well as amused, because the judge wrote in his decision that he was glad he hadn't been asked to compare Sharknado with The Sound and the Fury. Some years ago, another classic novel of that era found its way into a criminal appeals court in Texas, a place where life and death decisions are made. The results there were less entertaining, more disturbing. Julia Barton has our story.
Kathy Cochran is one of 9 judges on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. But our story starts in the 1960s, when she was an army wife in Monterey, California.
We lived right above Cannery Row when we were first married, and so I reread all of Steinbeck when we lived there.
Cochran had grown up in rural California, farm country, and she loved how Steinbeck depicted the underbelly of the state.
George stood up and threw the mouse as far as he could into the darkening brush, and then he stepped to the pool and washed his hands. You crazy fool! Don't you think I could see your feet was wet where you went across the river to get it?
He heard Lenny's whimpering cry and wheeled about, blubbering like a baby. Jesus Christ, a big guy like you. He always has such good stories about the importance of connecting with people, realistic portrayals of human beings that were outside of, at least at that time, the general reading public.
People like Lenny Small, a big guy, strong, but mentally disabled. Lenny loves little animals, but often crushes them by accident. Of Mice and Men tells the story of Lenny and another ranch hand, George, who takes him under his wing.
Lenny's lip quivered and tears started in his eyes. "Oh, Lenny." George put his hand on Lenny's shoulder. "I ain't taken away just for meanness. That mouse ain't fresh, Lenny. And besides, you broke it petting it. You get another mouse that's fresh, and I'll let you keep it a little while." Lenny sat down on the ground and hung his head dejectedly. "I don't know where there is no other mouse. I remember a lady used to give 'em to me, ever one she got, but that lady ain't here."
So heartbreaking.
It is. I mean, Lenny's sort of the gentle giant, not realizing what he's doing, not knowing the consequences. And I think that's part of what was behind the Atkins case as well.
The Atkins case was a Supreme Court ruling from 2002 that it's unconstitutional to execute mentally retarded people. And yes, retarded is the term the court used. Many states adopted a clinical definition of retardation based on IQ, the kind of standard a social worker would use to assess somebody for disability benefits. But in Texas, the job of defining who could and couldn't be executed fell to the appeals court. Kathy Cochran was the judge who wound up writing the state's rules, and she remembered Steinbeck's Lenny.
Certainly, we can all agree that somebody like Lenny from Of Mice and Men is exactly the sort of person that people would say, Lenny should not be executed. Lenny, although he had strangled Curly's wife, clearly he was not really morally culpable.
That's because Lenny doesn't even understand that he's killed the woman.
Don't do that! George is gonna be mad if you get.
This is from the 1992 movie starring Gary Sinise and John Malkovich.
Don't want to hurt you, but you're going to get me in trouble.
Cochran's ruling says that someone who is retarded could still be executed if he showed signs of moral culpability. For example, if he had the ability to plot the crime he committed.
Is this someone who's a leader or a follower? Is this someone who can lie effectively and can spin a good story and keep things straight?
I would point out that a toddler or a three-year-old is perfectly capable of stealing a cookie, breaking a flower pot, and lying about it.
That's Margaret Nygren, head of the American Association for Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. She says it's a mistake to take Steinbeck's Lenny as a baseline for what retardation means.
The character is a person who I would say on the face of it was intended to describe someone with moderate to severe intellectual disability, not someone in the mild end of the spectrum.
That's where the problems are, Nygren says, people on the mild end of the spectrum.
The social judgment may not be there. They may not quite understand that the person interrogating them is being less than truthful. They may not be able to make eye contact. They may be so agreeable and wanting to please those around them that they are unable to successfully contribute to their own defense.
Even some people who are more profoundly disabled have recently been executed in Texas.
In a case that I worked on, the court invoked under one of the factors that the client was not mentally retarded because he was married and had a child, as if human love and reproduction is something that people with mental retardation are not capable of.
Lee Kovarsky is a law professor who represents death row inmates. He's talking about a man from Beaumont, Texas, named Marvin Wilson. Wilson had an IQ of 61, putting him at the bottom 1% of human intelligence. A court-appointed doctor testified that Wilson could barely read, write, handle money. But a lower court ruled that he functioned sufficiently in his younger years to hold jobs, get a driver's license, marry, and have a child. He was executed by lethal injection last year.
And they ain't got nobody in the world that gives a hoot and hell about it.
But not us. That's it, George. But not us. Tell about us now.
Of Mice and Men ends with Lenny hiding out in a grove of trees. George finds him there, ahead of the posse that's coming to hunt Lenny down.
I got you.
And I got you, George. That's what that gives a hoot and hell about us, George. But tell now how it's going to be.
We're going to get a little place.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to get a little place, and
We're going to
have...
We have a cow, some pigs, we're going to have maybe a chicken. Down the flat, we'll have a little field.
The reason that George shoots Lenny is because he knows if he gets caught, this is exactly what's going to happen to him.
This is John Steinbeck's son, Thomas.
He wants Lenny to die with the happiest thoughts he can. He doesn't want him terrified. He doesn't want him bullied. He doesn't want him tortured. You know, he doesn't want him frightened year after year waiting for his own execution, even if he understands what that means.
Judge Cochran says she cites literature to make the law more clear and accessible. A book like Of Mice and Men can give us empathy, but it doesn't necessarily give us the truth. John Steinbeck was a novelist, not a psychiatrist.
To judge anything based upon a piece of fiction, I think is really a stretch. And I think it would have made my father extremely angry.
Because the irony of Judge Cochran's ruling is that Steinbeck opposed the death penalty for anyone.
I remember once my father saying, if you have to take another man's blood to make your point, you haven't thought out the question very thoroughly.
For Studio 360, I'm Julia Barton.
There's a bill in the Texas Senate right now that would do away with Judge Cochran's Lenny test and adopt a more scientific standard for mental disability in deciding capital punishment cases. It's sponsored by two Democrats, but the conservative editorial page of the Dallas Morning News has also come out in favor of that bill. Renata Adler had the career that writers just dream of. At age 24, a young star at The New Yorker. Then, at 29, a film critic for The New York Times, the first woman to hold that job. For The New Yorker, she reported on the civil rights movement, the war in Biafra, Watergate. She wrote important essays. She posed for Richard Avedon. She went to the right parties and knew all the important people. In 1976, still in her 30s, she published her first novel, Speedboat, to great acclaim, and her second, Pitch Dark, 5 years later. And then things changed. In the 80s, she was purged from the fancy circles where she'd been the it girl. Her books went out of print, and for the last 30 years, she has not published any fiction at all. But she's always had fans, including me. Both of Renata Adler's novels have recently been republished, putting her back in the literary spotlight. And she joins me now. Renata Adler, welcome to Studio 360.
Well, thanks.
So you published these two novels 30 and 37 years ago. And they were out of print, I guess?
Oh, yes, they were.
I assume you had not reread these novels?
I had not reread these novels, no. And in fact, don't usually reread things after they've been in print because there's nothing you can do about it anymore. But this time I thought, well, all right. I mean, she's not grown up not to read them. I will now read them.
Did you think, this isn't bad?
Sometimes I thought this isn't bad. Sometimes I thought this is incredibly embarrassing. It's so bad. And then sometimes
it's like writing a book.
It's like writing a book. And then to my surprise, I thought, oh, you know, to the degree I thought about it at all, I thought, I was amazed to think those were 30 years and whatever, 100 years, how many it's been.
About 100.
About 100 years since Speedboat, maybe 75 years
yeah.
since Pitch Dark.
And so it didn't strike you as a period piece in any way or as, oh, I was so young and thought differently about the world then.
No, it didn't, which was sort of a surprise. And then Pitch Dark, which in a way had meant much more to me and in a way still does – they didn't seem was I ever like that?
Yeah. Both Speedboat and Pitch Dark are more collage-like than they are of scenes and perceptions than conventional plotty novels. But you've said many times you've always been a great reader, of lover of old-fashioned plotty novels. So do you feel as though the literary fashions of that moment sort of guided your hand to write them that way rather than what you really wanted to write?
No, I don't think it was that. I had no intention of doing anything with the fragmentary quality at all, and wasn't even aware in that sense that it was, because I knew not anything could go anywhere. So I'd think, well, there's too much of this, and now we need some of this, right? So I was thinking,
it wasn't random, in other words.
It wasn't random, but it also didn't, in my head, lack plot. But then Pitch Dark does have a plot, and it even has a
much
a
more
chase.
So. Yes.
It even has a chase.
No, it's a more normal piece of fiction.
Well, yeah, but also the middle section actually was written as, I guess, what I've never thought of till this minute, as a chase. I mean, it was suspenseful. It was suspenseful for me for a while, and then when I saw what it was too out of context. I mean, I just had to put in this other stuff. So I'm surprised that why not just leave it a sequence, sequence?
But that gets back to my question about literary fashion. Did you feel, oh, I have to art this up a bit?
No, not art.
No?
No, I did think, well, you know, I may be wrecking this. I just need to do this. I think, this is a very odd thought, I didn't want anything to be too obviously what it is.
Well, I'd love to have you read a bit of that chase from the central section of Pitch Dark. It's the scene where the book's narrator, a newspaper reporter called Kate Ennis, is in Ireland. She's trying to put some distance between herself and her married lover. And then she has this minor accident in her rental car, which makes her feel like a fugitive on the lam.
Okay. Beside the road, invisible, the fields, the long stone walls. On the road, few cars, three perhaps an hour, all of them coming towards me, nobody following them, no one in pursuit. And yet, as I passed through small, dark, widely separated towns, I wondered whether my headlights and engine were noticed, whether a policeman, perhaps, or some sleepy but eager informer had picked up the receiver and called the next town. Phones ringing then from town to town, not even for me necessarily. What lawful errand, after all, could send a cheap, small, rented car out on a southern Irish road at this speed, in this weather, at this hour? Except that, with any luck, it no longer gave it much sign of being a rented car. That afternoon, in broad daylight, I had peeled its rental sticker off. In fact, though I did not know at what precise moment I had crossed over into crime, that removal must have marked a turning point. On the one hand, they could say that it proved guilt, or at least criminal intent. I, on the other hand, I could make what I had begun to think of as the argument of, what kind of fool do you take me for? I mean, do you take me for such a fool as to remove a rental sticker in broad daylight when what I have in mind is a furtive escape? The argument I knew hardly ever worked, in politics or criminal law or private life. And yet, in my case, there was no criminal record and so little evidence. It made no sense for me to be doing what I seemed to be doing, in view of what little I had done. I might prevail. Sleet came down. It was pitch dark.
That is Renata Adler reading from her novel Pitch Dark. And as you say, that passage is in no way some highfalutin experimental fiction
thing. No. It's just running like hell and then hitching a ride and so on.
You said earlier that you are more fond of this book than you are of Speedboat. How come? You were just doing it better the second time?
Well, no. I guess I had thought both abstractly and in real life, that there is this tension between modernism, however you define it, and feeling, and that there are very few of the effects, the most valuable effects of feeling that you can get if you're a modernist. And it's partly out of dread of kitsch, which is the thing of saying, oh, this is so obvious, I know exactly what it is. And it's partly like the loss of melody in music, but music will get you. I mean, if music will, you'll get whatever feeling the music asks you to get, probably.
But the same thing happened in mid-20th century.
The same thing happened in the mid-20th century. And most of the – I mean, I don't know that many modernists, but people that I knew that were in any sense modernist
– As fiction writers.
As fiction writers or as photographers. sort of despised feeling. I mean, they thought that those are cheaply won, it's sentimentality. And I remember saying to Richard Avedon, who was a friend, I said, you know, I have sort of this housemaid side. That is, I cry at the movies, and I like there to be a plot, and I like to care about who gets what, and it matters to me, and I even watch soap operas, you know. And he said, I hate that. And he said it nicely, but he meant it. He didn't want it in his work. He just didn't want that, and I did want it in mine.
You had been the film critic for The New York Times before you started publishing fiction, a film critic for The New Yorker. Had you, like so many journalists and critics and nonfiction writers, always wanted to write a novel? Was that the brass ring, or a brass ring?
No. What happened was that I didn't expect to be a writer at all because I had this difficulty writing, and it's so embarrassing, you know, to be published. And then it turns out when I became the film critic for The New York Times, the way out of that embarrassment is not to stop writing and being published. The only way out of whatever you did wrong and that you regret in your last piece is to do the next one, which is already due anyway. So the way to erase is go forward. But no.
That sounds like how criminals become criminals too, probably.
Well, I think they're probably akin. They're probably akin. But I just thought if you're going to be a critic, it isn't really fair not to have tried the thing you're writing about.
I couldn't agree with you more. There are certain things that one can be a critic of, and you can't expect a film critic to have directed a film.
No, but, or a ballet critic to have danced.
But writing books.
Yeah. Because there's something awful about this critic who sits there, who Lord knows for most of my working life I was, who sits there. And there you are. You've got 5 hours if you're at a newspaper. And that's it. You know, and if you might have liked it on another day or you may have not liked it.
Yes.
It just seemed
And
not.
These 3 years that you spent doing that, eh.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Because if you knew if you took the full weight of that, it just isn't right.
Yeah. And you've also written a third novel?
Yeah, but where is it? You know, why don't I?
I was going to ask you that very question.
Yes, why haven't I turned it in? And I just got to turn it in. I guess.
Well, why did you take 30 years to write another one?
I have a lot of trouble writing. That's basically what it is. It's just hard for me.
Yeah.
Not always. Every once in a while, there's something I think this, but it lasts a page or two.
Mm-hmm. But you feel sort of back in the saddle and you want to keep writing?
I never feel back in the saddle, but I'd like to keep writing, sure. Sure, I'd like to keep writing. And then, of course, the thing we all want is not to die miserably, preferably. I mean, and the rest.
Well, may you not die miserably or soon.
Well, thank you, as a friend of mine says, and you the same.
Renata Adler, thank you very much. Renata Adler's novels Speedboat and Pitch Dark are now out in new editions. Still ahead today in Studio 360. They may be the youngest guests I've ever had on the show, but they're plenty confident about their futures as heavy metal musicians. I mean, do you figure in 5 years you'll still be doing this?
Yes, I'm going to do this until I die.
Seriously, you think this is your life?
I will retire about, 70 years old.
You'll always be broken.
With a current combined age of 35, Unlocking the Truth rocks Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Malcolm Brickhouse.
Alec Atkins.
Jared Dawkins.
My name's Kurt Anderson.
Slay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I am Kurt Anderson. We have been on a summer journey with the humorist Jack Handy in celebration of his first novel, The Stench of Honolulu. Over the last few weeks, we've seen him through encounters with an old crone, a swarm of vicious bats, and most recently, an historic discovery.
When the mist cleared, something amazing began rising up from the jungle. It was the fabulous ruins of an ancient civilization. I have to admit, the ruins were impressive, but like so many civilizations, they forgot the one rule that might have saved them. Don't let vines grow all over you.
And now, the final installment in our series, read by the author.
Women love a man who makes them laugh. And what's the one thing that makes women laugh? Puppets. Later that day, as we sailed through a narrow stretch of river, I made a puppet out of a sock. It was actually just a sock, but if you make a funny high voice, it becomes a puppet.
Hey, where's Leilani?
I said in the high voice. I made the sock turn from side to side, like he was looking around for something. Leilani pulled the puppet off my hand and threw it overboard. What was wrong with her? Was she crazy? A pretty girl who was also crazy was something I'd never heard of. I kept my cool. Calmly, slowly, I climbed to the top of the cabin. I became perfectly still. Then, with a jolt, I began doing my funny cowboy dance. I pulled out all the stops. I did the agitated leg while the other leg is straight, the tiptoe prance, the bow-legged forward scoot, and the galloping in place with eyes crossed. The monkeys in the trees began screaming. Hold on, monkeys, I'm just getting warmed up. Get down, said Leilani. Oh yeah, mama, I'm getting down. I did the cowboy peekaboo before switching to the pretending to lasso something that pulls you off your feet. Get down, Leilani yelled. She and Don hit the deck. Something stuck in my forehead. It was a blow dart. I pulled the dart out and threw it away. But it stuck in my foot. I threw it away again. My head started swimming. I began to shimmy uncontrollably, like Uncle Lou before the paramedics came. My whole body was heaving upward, like Uncle Lou when they applied the electric paddles to him. I began to curse hysterically, like Uncle Lou when he got the hospital bill. Here's a tip. If your friend Don says, bite down on this, he means the stick in his hand, not his finger. Leilani appeared, hovering over my face, chewing gum. No, wait, she's not chewing gum, she's chewing leaves from her basket. She took the pulp out of her mouth and applied it to my forehead and my foot. As she leaned over me, I wanted to kiss her, but she had really bad leaf breath. I don't know if you've ever had a blow dart hangover, but they are the worst. It makes you swear never to get hit by one again. I decided to make one last play for Leilani. I poured a couple of scotches, fluffed up my beret, and sat down next to her. I want to thank you for what you did, I said, pointing to my foot, which was three times its normal size. She didn't say anything. I continued, but I don't understand. Who would want to shoot us with poison darts? Teenagers? Teenagers, said Leilani, irritated. Not teenagers, natives. Natives, but why? White man steal land, bring disease, make native feel like stranger in own country. I wanted to tell her, first of all, that Don and I were there to steal gold, not land. And second, what were the other things again? Over the next few days, I was hit by at least 20 more blow darts. I was hit by several as I was standing on the front tip of the boat, pretending to be a hood ornament, as a joke. When I woke up, I asked Leilani how many blow darts had hit me. She seemed annoyed. What, me your personal blow dart counter? Thank you.
You can hear all four of Jack Handy's excerpts from The Stench of Honolulu at studio360.org. And a big thank you to our beloved listeners in Hawaii who have been such good sports about this. And we promise we'll never do it again. I haven't been much of a metal fan since junior high, but I was blown away by a video that made the rounds online a few weeks ago. It was of a band called Unlocking the Truth. They were rocking out in the middle of Times Square while executing a mean metal breakdown, and the crowd was just eating it up.
Yes.
The band can really play, but what's even more amazing is that these three black kids from Brooklyn are in middle school. They'll enter the seventh grade in September. For now, Unlocking the Truth is on summer vacation, which is why they have time for us. Malcolm Brickhouse, Jared Dawkins, Alec Atkins, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I wouldn't ordinarily start by asking this, but how old are each of you, Malcolm?
I'm 12 years old.
I'm 12 years old.
I'm 11.
And Jared, you're the young one?
Yeah.
You're all about to be in seventh grade. Right?
Yeah.
And when did each of you first pick up instruments, Malcolm?
I picked up an instrument when I was 5.
The guitar?
It was a piano.
Oh, really?
And then, like a year later, my mom bought me a guitar, and I liked that one more instead of the piano.
I picked up the bass about 1 year now.
Oh, so you're new.
Yeah.
Jared, you started drumming when?
Since 2 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
And Jared, you and Malcolm have been playing together for a while, yeah?
Right, 7 years now.
And how did that happen? You were just both, what, kindergartners, and you realized you both liked to rock?
My dad used to take us to wrestling shows, and we used to watch animated music videos, and, like, the background music was heavy metal.
Aha.
So I was surrounded by heavy metal. And then one day Jared asked me if I wanted to start a band. And I said yes, and this is where we are now.
And you were 5 or something?
5, 6.
I just didn't know 5-year-olds were in the business of saying, hey, do you want to start a band?
Yeah.
And you've been doing it pretty much since. But this band, you've called it different things.
Yeah, at first it was Up and Under. Then, like 2 years later, it was Tears of Blood. And then
it was Unlocking the Truth.
Unlocking the Truth is a good name for a band. So you're going to stick with that, I guess.
Yeah.
We'll talk some more, but can you guys play a song?
Yeah.
This is Unlocking the Truth, performing their song, Escape. We'll be right back. That was Unlocking the Truth. Malcolm Brickhouse on guitar, Jared Dawkins on drums, and Alec Atkins on bass. So without vocals, without words, I wonder, what does that song mean to you? Or is it just all musical?
Well, I have lyrics to this song.
Really? And so why don't you sing?
Because we can't sing.
Really?
Yeah.
You need
our voices are not strong enough.
Aha. So does that mean when your voices get stronger, you'll start singing or you'll get a singer in the meantime?
Well,
we don't want to sing.
We are looking for one. They don't want us to look for one, but...
They, meaning your parents?
Yeah. Sorry.
So all these songs you write have lyrics?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Huh.
And are they like standard metal lyrics or give me a sense of what
is standard metal lyrics?
I don't know. Satan. I don't know. What are these songs about?
It is not about Satan.
Okay, good. That's
I'm
good to
Christian.
Hear.
I'm a Christian. It's about drugs and relationships and stuff. That's what it's mainly about.
Gotcha.
And being free.
I have read that you guys in school, you know, because there's some nail polish going on, you wear black and you don't dress like, I guess, most of the kids you go to school with, they hassle you. Is that true?
They call you things like fag.
Yeah? And you just say, and you just ignore them, or what do?
I ignore them.
Yeah?
They make songs about it.
And you make songs about it. Well, there you go. That's what creative work is supposed to be. You turn the hard stuff into art.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been, for a year, you were playing pretty much every weekend in Times Square.
Yeah, since last year.
I know you stopped, but I want to hear about that.
Yeah, we made a lot of money.
You made a lot of money?
Yeah, we made a lot of money.
Like, how much would you make in a day?
About $1,600.
No, really?
Yeah.
That's not the number I was expecting. I'm really impressed. That must have been good experience.
Yeah, it was. It gets tiring after a while. You're staying out there for 10 hours a day.
Do you see that? I mean, do you figure in 5 years you'll still be doing this?
Yeah.
Yes. I would do this until I die.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. But you seriously, you think this is your life?
I would retire about like 70 years old.
You'll also be broken by the time it's his arms. He wouldn't be able to play anymore.
Have any of the other kids you go to school with seen you perform?
Not live. But on
yeah, right.
Yeah, on YouTube.
Do they now think, maybe these guys are cool?
No.
One person in my class is jealous of me.
Good.
But I don't really care.
I want to thank you all for coming today. This has been great.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Unlocking the Truth is Malcolm Brickhouse, Jared Dawkins, and Alec Atkins. You can see a video of the band performing for us here in Studio 360 at studio360.org. And maybe before you actually leave, you can play one more for us as we go out, maybe a cover version or something?
Yeah, Master of Puppets
from Metallica.
And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes...
Ital Malad.
David Krasnow.
Michelle Siegel.
Jenny Lawton.
John Delore.
Sean Ramisferam.
Alana Harper.
Anne Hepperman.
Eric Malinsky.
Chloe Plant.
Rachel Lewis Krisky.
Ellen Mayer.
Mark Sheely.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiga. So you listen to Studio 360. Why not take it to the next level? You can like, friend, and otherwise stay in touch with us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/Studio360Show. And on Twitter, it's at Studio360Show. And I'm at KB Anderson. That's Anderson, S-E-N.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the former First Lady of France. Carla Bruni sings, she acts, and she's kind of funny.
I don't think it's the same to sing in Italian, in French, or in German. French people are Italian people in a bad mood.
Carla Bruni plays songs from her new album, And I Briefly Fall in Love, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Et quand on sait plus où aller,